tablets and her anemia will improve and it'll go away. But the causes of anemia over, say, large populations among women are much more entrenched in context. Why are women anemic? Because, for example, there is gender preference for boys over girls. So young girls are not given the same amount of food in some developing country situations as boys are.
Hello and welcome to Insights from Abroad. This podcast is part of the Middle East and South Asia Initiative in the College of Sciences at the University of Central Florida. And my name is David Callahan. Our mission here is to educate, engage, and influence the international community. Today I am joined by Dr. Karima Khalil to discuss some topics surrounding our Middle East series. Dr. Khalil, thank you for joining me today.
Hi.
So just so listeners are aware, Karima Khalil is a Swedish-Egyptian public health physician and evaluation specialist with over 20 years' research and management experience in the Middle East. Karima led the Reproductive Health Research Program at the Population Council's West Asia and North Africa Regional Office in Cairo for 10 years. Karima is a graduate of Smith College, Ain Shams Medical School, and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Currently a public health consultant based in India, Karima is a member of the American University in Beirut-based research collective's Choices and Challenges in Changing Childbirth and the Reproductive Health Working Group, and is a trustee of Reproductive Health Matters. Karima is a past trustee of two arts and culture foundations, the Friends of Ahmed Baha el-Din Foundation and Studio Imad Eddin, both in Egypt. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Just to start off, could you tell us a bit about your experiences in healthcare in the developing world?
Well, I graduated from medical school in Egypt, as you mentioned, and I only went to medical school because I wanted to work in public health. So I did that for a while. I started working on the first national survey of blood pressure or hypertension in Egypt. And then very soon after that, I got hired by the Population Council and became more involved in women's health. So for a long time, I was involved in trying to identify priority areas of doing research on women's health and doing proposal writing and designing research projects, looking at specific areas where we thought that there wasn't enough data and where we could, if we design studies well enough, we could bring those findings to policymakers and help redress areas where women's health was not being addressed adequately.
So with kind of developing healthcare in the developing world, what are some not well-known issues or maybe misunderstandings regarding developing healthcare?
I think that it's very tempting sometimes to think that if you throw enough money at a problem, or if you have a technical solution for a problem, then you can solve the problem and the health problem will go away. And as doctors, sometimes we think, you know, oh, if I can just get in there and intervene and, like, you know, operate, then everything will be fine. And we take that kind of attitude over, and often it is. I mean, if you're a surgeon and you excise a tumor, or you're an orthopedist and you plaster somebody's broken bone, then that's it. You know, that problem is solved. In public health, I think it's much more complex because there's so many factors that affect health and disease, and the context is super important. So if you have long-standing intractable health problems, these are often multifactorial, or usually multifactorial. They're not, you know, women are, say, for example, say there's a very high level of anemia in the developing world. Well, you can, for the individual woman, give her iron tablets and her anemia will improve and it'll go away. But the causes of anemia over, say, large populations among women are much more entrenched in context. Why are women anemic? Because, for example, there is gender preference for boys over girls. So young girls are not given the same amount of food in some developing country situations as boys are. So the boys will grow up not being anemic, but the girls will grow up being anemic. And it's not just a question of, you know, distributing iron tablets, which will of course address the immediate anemia, but it's much more important to address the underlying cause, which is, say, sun preference. So I would go back and say that some of the misunderstandings about public health are that you can't just throw money at something, like I said, and have the problem go away, but you have to really understand what are all the contributing factors to that problem and try to address those one by one, which of course is very not only challenging to identify what they are, but then challenging to address them and find the political will to address many different things, which maybe are cultural mores, social habits, tradition, that there's no political will really or social will to redress.
With your focus in women's health specifically, what challenges face developing women's health as opposed to men's health or just health of the population in general?
Well, one challenge that leaps to mind is maternal mortality or women dying in childbirth. And maternal mortality obviously affects women more than men. I mean, ultimately everybody in the family is affected, but I mean, the main fatality, of course, is the woman or the delivering woman. And globally, I think as of, say, 2015, the global estimates for women dying in childbirth around the world was in the region of 300,000 women a year, which breaks down to about 800 women a day, which breaks down to more than a jumbo jet a day crashing. If you think of a jumbo jet crashing every single day where all the passengers are young women who are pregnant, that sort of brings that home to you. But so that obviously is something that affects women more than men. Of course, everybody, as I said, is affected, and when the mother of the family is lost to a maternal death, then of course the husband suffers, the children suffers. There's data that shows that of all the women who die in childbirth, half of their babies die as well, do not survive the mother's death for various reasons. This is probably one of the more intractable problems. There have been huge strides in improvements in maternal mortality over the last 20 years, and many countries have brought their maternal mortality ratios down by maybe half to two-thirds. 99% of all maternal deaths happen in developing countries, and I think about a third of all maternal deaths happen in South Asia. So this is a huge challenge for countries that are still developing, that have not enough resources, that have challenges in offering adequate maternity and healthcare in general to women who are often, the majority of the deaths happen to women who are living in rural areas, who are poor, who are anemic to begin with, who do not have the financial resources, obviously because they're poor, but also maybe do not have access to education and are not aware and do not have sufficient information about family planning and contraception, so they tend to have babies younger, at a younger age, and they tend to have more of them, and they tend to have them at closer intervals, all of which is quite debilitating. So I would say that is one of the major public health problems facing women globally, but certainly not the only one.
I know in South Asia they have this phenomenon that I've read a little bit on, like called menstruation huts, and deaths associated with that. Is that another kind of big issue, at least in the region? And I know it happens specifically in rural areas. Is that kind of another women's health issue that you have to tackle, not with just single issue fixing, but kind of the more broad educational stuff?
Yes, that's not an area. I mean, I've heard of it, but it's not an area that I know too much about. But my understanding is that menstruation is seen in some South Asian areas as being extremely unclean, and women are sort of sequestrated during menstruation and forced to either remain, you know, within the household or within their rooms, or sent, as you say, outside to be in a hut and sort of menstruate there, and are often not given food or, you know, enough adequate nutrition while that's going on. So obviously all these attitudes around quote unquote cleanliness and purity and et cetera around menstruation and sort of the defiling that comes around, that is around that, is very problematic for women in general.
So healthcare policy is kind of an interdisciplinary approach requiring politics and healthcare knowledge. Do you see a sort of disconnect between government policies or goals and the practical healthcare needs?
I don't know if there's a disconnect between the policy and the needs. Perhaps there's a disconnect between the policy and the steps that are taken to redress the needs. Maybe that is what you meant by that question. But policymakers, I mean, I don't envy policymakers in the developing world or in the developed world for that matter, but policymakers have a tough row to hoe. They have limited resources. They have to identify priorities. They have to decide where to put their dollars or their rupees or their pounds. And it's often or usually an extremely difficult choice. And often the challenge is that you don't have adequate data to tell you where you will get most bang for your buck. So if you say, for example, if you're in a country that has enacted a lot of different health policies, you've done some improvements in your antenatal care, you've made contraception more available to an extent, you've improved healthcare delivery a little bit, you've trained a few more doctors to attend deliveries, and you find that your maternal mortality ratio, the number of women who die in childbirth, has come down. But you don't know, it's very important for you to know which of those interventions had the most impact so that then you can do more of it. So if it was, building more hospitals and you have, your $100, you'll put your $100 in building more hospitals. But if it wasn't building the more hospitals that had the most impact, it was in fact making contraception more widely available, then you should put your $100 there. So often, resource poor countries are also data poor, not necessarily poor in the terms of the amount of data that they have. Often they're drowning in numbers, but they might be poor in analyzing those numbers adequately and evaluating what they mean so that they can understand or better plan where to put their resources to have the biggest impact. Often there's policymakers put a lot of emphasis on collection of data and meeting targets. So we vaccinated this many under fives, we distributed this many contraceptives, we saw this many women received antenatal care services, but the numbers just sort of go up and up and up and up to the highest levels of monitoring and evaluation, and nobody really sometimes puts them together. And it becomes extremely important also to not just look at the numbers of people who are accessing care or receiving these vaccinations, etc., but the quality of that care. Are all the women who are having 5 to 6 antenatal visits during their pregnancy, well, what is actually happening in those antenatal visits? It becomes even more important to know that. So sometimes, or always, we have to remember not just to focus on the numbers, but what is actually behind those numbers.
So with your present work, do you work more with collecting this data for these data poor countries, or do you work more with the analysis of what the data means, or do you do a bit of both?
I do a bit of both, but I try to always remind everyone I'm working with that the numbers aren't everything. The numbers are extremely important. I mean, quantitative data collection is extremely important. It's also a very, very challenging thing to do, to make sure that you're collecting the right numbers about what you're really aiming to study. So you have to design your data collection tools extremely carefully so that they're telling you what you need to know and not telling you something else. They're answering a question that you're asking, not answering some other question. But numbers, sometimes I like to say that numbers really just tell you what the problem is, but they don't tell you what is causing the problem or how to address it. So you might know that there are X numbers of women suffering from this or X numbers of children, etc. But why that is, you're not going to get that from the number. And for that, you have to really look at the context. And looking at the context requires a much more qualitative approach. And ideally, you should have medical anthropologists with you on your team. I'm always for having multidisciplinary teams where you have qualitative people working alongside you and guiding you and helping you, because if you don't understand the why and the how, you'll never know how to redress it.
So with improving healthcare in the developing world, is it more of a one-way relationship regarding taking knowledge from the developed world and applying it to the developing world? Or is it kind of a back and forth that practices and policies that you see in your regions can be applied in places like America or in Europe?
I would say it's certainly not a question of taking all the lessons learned in the developed world and applying them sort of ipso facto in the developing world. Did I say that right? Not from the developed world to the developing
yes.
world? Okay. So it's certainly not that. And God knows we've all seen many, 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 many instances of projects where, you know, something worked fantastically in Sweden or, you know, Germany or the United States. And we're like, okay, let's apply this now in this tiny village in Egypt and or India or something where, you know, it's ridiculous to think that something will work in an infrastructure of a certain type in the West, where you are in a health unit in a rural area in a developing country where they have electricity half an hour a day, or people have to walk 20 miles to reach the facility, or, you know, say you, for example, circulate, think like, okay, let's give out these health education pamphlets, and you design them and et cetera, and you have neglected to notice that, well, actually people here are illiterate, and so, you know, it's a, you know, circulating these pamphlets is not going to be useful. Or even now, for example, with a lot of mobile technology, with having sort of apps that, you know, health apps on your phone that, for example, can remind women when to go for antenatal care, or, I mean, some of these are really useful and have worked really well in some areas, and other apps just completely fail because people don't take into consideration women's access also to mobile phones, and often women don't have access to mobile phones, or they don't have access to recharging them, or they don't have access to the money to buy the chip or to buy a larger memory card, or they don't have access to electricity to charge the phone, like I said. Or sometimes women having, or young, particularly with younger women, having access to mobile phones is actually a risk factor for domestic violence, where male members of the family might suspect that young women are using mobile phones to have contact with, you know, guys in their community, and that is frowned upon, and therefore women might be subjected to domestic violence within their own family because they have a mobile phone that they're seen to be using. So you can't fly into a situation like that and say, I'm going to give every woman a mobile phone and they're going to know when they can therefore access antenatal care or go for contraception or get health messages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you haven't understood the context properly of the factors that impact women's use of mobile phones in these situations.
So you kind of acknowledge a lot of these challenges, such as like literacy, access to technology, access to certain resources like electricity. Are you working with other departments within these governments to kind of maybe apply those? So for example, when it comes to literacy, working with the education department within the government to kind of help that as well while you're doing healthcare?
No. Typically, people who are working in public health just stick to that. But what you need to do and always remember is to, when you have public health recommendations, to make them as practical as possible. So you would point out, for example, what I said about mobile telephony and the context in which it, you know, context that where women access mobile telephones, and just make that very, very, very clear in anything you're recommending that, you know, we recommend, for example, that you use this antenatal program on this app on mobile telephones, but remember that, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then put all the contextual, the socioeconomic and cultural, you know, factors in your recommendation so that the people who, policymakers, see that, they, it's their role to link with, say, the people in the local, you know, education councils, etc. And but at least we as public health people can point out that they have to take this into account.
Oh, what's one thing that governments, non-governmental organizations, and intergovernmental organizations can do to sort of fix or at least address a lot of these issues?
Well, that's kind of a big question, but NGOs are perhaps have more freedom to be more creative and sit with I mean, public health people obviously have to do this as well, but it's very, very important to sit with people, sit with women and sit with men and sit with communities and understand what their priorities are and try to come up with solutions that are very context specific and sensitive to communities. And sometimes, I mean, we wish that policymakers would do that. Sometimes they don't have enough time and resources to do that. And that is, I think, where NGOs can contribute a lot, especially if they are in communities and where they encourage people in the community to be part of what they're doing and be sort of, you know, give the community a voice.
How can our listeners get more involved with either your specific cause or your field in general?
I think the internet is a wonderful thing, and I think you can find out almost anything you want by using it and reading up on issues like maternal health, maternal mortality, contextual factors in the developing world, and YouTube is an equally wonderful thing, and you can watch all kinds of public health challenges and projects and messages by looking at that.
Well, Dr. Khalil, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today, and we thank you so much for being here and sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about today's guest, our mission, or our program, visit us at our website or go follow any of our social media pages. For the Middle East and South Asia Studies program here at UCF, this is David Callahan. Thank you for listening.